Fall is the time of year when illness can be transmitted more quickly, with school back in session and nearly all of us in closer quarters inside. I'm Lori Townsend. There's been a lot of recent attention nationally about the fear of the Ebola virus infecting Americans now that there's been a case in Texas. Ebola is a lot less likely to be diagnosed in Alaska, but what about enterovirus 68 or TB or the next strain of severe flu? What do Alaskans need to know about infectious disease and how to guard against it? How are healthcare providers in the state preparing and monitoring for outbreaks? Infectious disease is the topic today.
Today's
on Talk of Alaska.
Program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the historic Anchorage Hotel, offering space for rehearsal dinners, engagement parties, business meetings, or social gatherings. A boutique hotel in the heart of downtown. HistoricAnchorageHotel.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and today we are taking a break from politics and the political season to talk about a timely issue, infectious disease, and what Alaskans need to know. Alaska has a lot of painful history when it comes to the devastating effects of infectious disease. People were taken from their homes and sent to hospitals outside of the state because of tuberculosis. The pandemic flu, also known as the Spanish flu, wiped out entire families and villages in Alaska. Whooping cough flares up periodically, and the concern over a new and perhaps more lethal flu strain is one that ramps up nearly every year at this time. How concerned should Alaskans be now that the first case of Ebola in the United States has happened? What are state health officials doing to safeguard residents here? We're fortunate today to have two people who are well-equipped to answer those questions. Dr. Joe McLaughlin is the state's top epidemiologist and chief of the Alaska Section of Epidemiology at Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. That's a mouthful. Welcome, Dr. McLaughlin.
You. Thank you, Lori.
Thanks for being here. And Dr. Michael Cooper is the top deputy epidemiologist and head of the Infectious Disease Division. Makes you kind of sound like a health cop. Welcome, Dr. Cooper.
Thanks so much, Lori.
Thanks for being here. Let's turn to the news of the week, Ebola. There is a man in serious condition in Texas, the first case in the United States. There was also, just last evening, news came out about a nurse in Madrid who developed the disease. How did this happen? How did a man who had recently traveled from Liberia, when he developed a fever, get sent home from the hospital with antibiotics? What's known about sort of the breakdown there? Dr. Cooper, you want to tackle that one?
Well, in terms of how it happened, I think part of that has to do with the nature of Ebola itself. It's a disease where if you're infected one day, you may feel fine. You cannot transmit that disease for up to 21 days. Now, usually that's more like 7, 8, 9, 10 days, but you can feel fine. People can examine you. They could probably do blood tests, take your temperature. You're fine until you develop symptoms. So a person could be in a part of the world like West Africa right now, be exposed, have a high-risk exposure to Ebola, have that exposure, have that percolating in their system, let's say, but then feel fine. They would pass any screenings. They would be able within 21 days to probably travel anywhere in the world, to be fair, and then they develop symptoms. So they're not infectious before that time, but you can see how easy it might be for somebody to become infected, travel anywhere, get out of the airport, off the bus, to their home, to wherever they want to be, and then one day they wake up and they've got a sore throat and a fever and they've started their symptoms. So you can see how easy it might be for them to travel. You can see how difficult it might be also for people to be thinking Ebola when you're somewhere like, you know, Dallas, Texas, or rural Alaska.
It seems that, to me, the real question, and I want to let people know that they can join us if they have questions and they'd like to get them answered today. Our number is 1-800-478-8255. That's the number statewide. And if you're in Anchorage, you can call 550-8422, 550-8422, and 1-800-478-8255 across the state. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. I think the big question comes in when he went to the hospital, wasn't feeling well, said, I just came back from Liberia. And they said, well, here's some antibiotics. Go home and get better. Mm-hmm. It seems that a big red flag was missed somehow. What's known about what happened there?
I wasn't there. Right. I don't know the details. I'm hearing a lot of this like you are, like most of the listeners are, which is through the media. So I can't say, you know, exactly what happened, what was missed, if anything. But what we're doing here is trying to make sure something does not get missed. We're doing everything possible to reach out to not only people so that they're aware, but to healthcare providers and to anybody that might come into contact with an Ebola suspect, with the person that has recently traveled from West Africa, had an exposure, and then made their way back to Alaska, and getting a clear message across to them of have a high index of suspicion. Ask for that travel history. Ask for any of 8 or 9 or 10 symptoms. And if the answers are yes, I've been in West Africa in an Ebola-affected area in the last 21 days. I've got a fever or an upset stomach or a sore throat. A red flag has to pop up. And I don't know if that was missed for sure in Dallas. I don't know the details, like I said, but we're making sure that we're maximizing the potential that everyone that could come into contact with a suspect is aware, is going to ask those questions. And if they get red flag answers, they're going to isolate and call us, call the state, call public health so that we can help, we're aware, and we can launch into the investigation.
A cameraman for NBC contracted Ebola and was sent yesterday. He arrived in Nebraska. So now we have a man being treated in Dallas and we have another man being treated in Nebraska. I was sort of surprised by that and thought, why wouldn't they want these cases to be in the same place with the same protocols? Are all hospitals required to be equipped and ready for anything that may show up infectious disease-wise? It seems like that's a pretty big burden for hospitals that may never see something like this. I was curious about having those cases in two different parts of the country. It just seems like there could be more risk associated with that.
Well, yeah, that's part of the message that they're trying to put out clearly, both the CDC and the World Health and, you know, every state. Ebola is something that can be contained with basic, tried and true, used for hundreds of years, infection control measures. Now, the first question that might come up is, well, why is it exploding in West Africa? Why has it become what it's become? They don't have basic infection control measures like we have in the U.S. And until you've been there, lived there, worked there, or even seen it in the media enough, you don't appreciate when you're in a healthcare system that has no real good public health infrastructure, no education out to the masses, hospitals without running water in the hospitals, reliable electricity sources, enough disposable gloves, enough, you know, equipment, everything. When all of that breaks down, something like Ebola has the chance to spread both in a community and in a hospital. However, in the United States, probably in every state, in every jurisdiction in the United States, you've got hospitals that have what it takes to contain Ebola, which is the basics, which is good infection control practices, basic precautions, which every healthcare worker, every nurse, every triage nurse, every tech, every doctor, every administrator is very familiar with. And you've got a good public health infrastructure across the U.S. also, which is all it takes to trace contacts and make sure that it doesn't have a chance to spread. Now, the important part of that is enforcing those. Everybody knows how to wash their hands. Everybody knows how to put on gloves and to take gloves off and to put on gowns and take gowns off appropriately. Does it always happen? Well, that's part of the problem, part of the potential problem. So our efforts are in reminding people about the importance of doing these very, very basic things.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are talking today about infectious disease and what our level of concern should be for things that we're seeing across the nation right now and in West Africa. And also, it's fall, so it's that time of year when our risk of contracting things from others is a little bit higher. You can join our conversation if you have questions or comments in the local area, Anchorage. You can call 550-8422, 550-8422. or across the state, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255, or email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. How realistically, and maybe Dr. McLaughlin, this is a question for you, how, or you, Dr. Cooper, realistically, how concerned should Alaskans be? We do have a lot of international travelers. We have, you know, this time of year, there's not so much going on in the fish processing arena, but there's people that come and go from a lot of places and enter into Alaska. How concerned should Alaskans be about this possibly happening here?
You know, what I've said is that while the risk in Alaska is lower than it is in some of these other states and parts of the world that have either lots of people from these affected countries or lots of healthcare volunteers that are mobilizing and going over to help in these countries and coming back. So while the risk in Alaska is lower because we have fewer people in those categories, the risk is real. You know, like you mentioned, we've got people that come from all over the world to work here seasonally. We've got lots of international travel. We've got domestic travel to, you know, daily. And so while we can say, well, the risk is low, we don't want to say, don't worry. We want to say the risk is real and be aware. So for the general public, someone who doesn't work in the transportation industry, healthcare industry, fire, police, you're not likely during the course of your job to come into contact with an Ebola suspect. However, you should maintain a level of awareness if you're traveling. Just be aware of basic recommendations, current status, current travel advisories. Are you traveling to a place in the world that may have activity or may have, you know, concerns about activity? Well, look online. Look on our website. It'll link you to the CDC's Ebola website. So be aware that the risk is lower than in other states and other parts of the world, but the risk is real, so be aware. However, for healthcare providers, for anybody that is in the role of potentially coming into a contact with a suspect, you know, I read a quote the other day that I think it was Tom Frieden even that said, healthcare workers should be afraid. We want them to be a bit afraid of this so that they are aware. So I'm not telling healthcare workers to be afraid, but I'm telling them to be very aware of all of the recommendations. And they're, again, they're pretty straightforward. Have a high index of suspicion. Travel history plus symptoms equal isolate that patient and call us. I mean, those are the immediate things you have to know. And be thinking, could I come into contact with a suspect, with somebody that has recently traveled? What is my role? Who am I going to call immediately and what do I do? So be thinking of those questions right now because, you know, like we talked about at the beginning, Ebola is a disease that you can get exposed to and not develop symptoms for up to 21 days. So you could be anywhere, really, when you develop those symptoms. So if you're in a job that you could come into contact with somebody in whatever setting, just think through it and be aware at this point is what we're asking people.
Dr. McLaughlin, what kicks into place when there is an alert that goes out? We have two people with Ebola in the United States now that are being treated. Does something get triggered when an issue, an infectious disease of this level of concern comes into the country? And does the CDC send something out to people at your level? Or what protocols come into play when this happens?
Yeah, so CDC does send out usually a health alert network message, and that'll go to healthcare providers and public health officials throughout the country. And then when we receive that health alert network message here in the section of epidemiology, then we disseminate that out to our key stakeholders. They are colleagues in public health, they're healthcare providers, and our tribal partners. So it goes out to a very wide network of folks here in Alaska. So that just sort of is the start of the information dissemination. Then what happens is oftentimes we'll get a call from people like you, Lori, and others who say, you know, can you come on the radio show or TV and let us know what's happening with this particular case? So we do a lot of media interviews. We also have a lot of phone calls that we make and communicate with our key partners. Those partners include infectious disease physicians here in Alaska, as well as public health officials, tribal partners. So a lot of meetings occur. And then we also have, what else would you say?
Yeah, like, well, our preparedness, our public health preparedness folks and state preparedness people that we're in touch with. And then it's kind of situation dependent, too. It depends on the disease and the risk to Alaskans if there's more to be done. So, for example, with Ebola, we conducted interagency teleconferences. We got together with our preparedness people and we said, name every single agency you can think of that might need to be at the table for a phone call to make sure everyone is on the same page and has the same clear messages and has a chance to ask us any questions they need to, so that we not only answer those, get people talking, but then they have our contact information and they can get in touch immediately. So we've done that. We've gotten together and done and offered and done multidisciplinary grand rounds. So we've gone to a couple of the hospitals, gotten together with the infectious disease physicians, like Dr. McLaughlin noted, infection control providers. We've, you know, delivered talks about Ebola 101 basics, what to do, how to put on and take off infection control attire, and opened it up for any questions. So other ongoing teleconferences, the list is long. We put them up on our website.
The list is definitely long. The other thing that happens fairly frequently at the height of the Ebola situation, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we were attending probably every other day national teleconferences to get situational updates. And so there's just a lot of information sharing happening. And as Dr. Cooper mentioned, we do try to provide links to key information on our webpage as well.
Mm-hmm. And in the other piece that is going on also that we're not always aware of is the hard work that's being done at the local clinics and the hospitals. And we're aware of some of it because we're in touch with them so much. But at the same time, a couple of days ago, in response to a media request, I called a couple of the hospitals and I said, can you just give me some bullet points on what you guys are doing? And I was impressed with not only are they doing and have they been doing the basic training on infection control practices, and they all have preparedness drills and bed influx and all kinds of things that they always work on. But in response to this, they have been going above and beyond in terms of, let's run through a walkthrough. Let's get a team together. Let's walk through and pretend we're a suspect of Ebola. Let's go to every, you know, section in the hospital, every floor, and see what we need to do. Let's get our engineering teams, our housekeeping teams. Let's get, you know, anyone we have to get on this team together now so that we can walk through a mock scenario. And so I've been impressed with what's been going on locally at a lot of the hospitals.
Do you think that maybe because Alaska has such a history of, unfortunately, a variety of infectious diseases, is there perhaps more of a sense of awareness here in Alaska than maybe in other places because of that? It sounds like there's some impressive protocols being fine-tuned at hospitals based on what you're saying. So maybe it's just, is it possible that it's just more top of mind? I'm asking you to speculate now, I realize.
It's, you know, it's hard to compare. I don't have that experience in other states and how, you know, ready they are and what they've experienced that well. But I can say certainly with, you know, the history of something like tuberculosis in Alaska, something that, you know, not more than 50 or 60 years ago, Alaska had what some people say are the highest rates ever seen anywhere in the world of tuberculosis. It just came through on the backs of some other New World diseases, you know, in the 1700s, 1800s, and just wiped out whole communities of people. It was, you know, the scourge of Alaska, it was called. And so a lot of the infrastructure that was built up around that and during that time has certainly played a role in, you know, the good infrastructure that exists now. I was thinking last night, I think some of the Alaska tourism industry, the fact that we get, you know, so many cruise ships, not just flights and people here, but so many cruise ships from passengers from around the world, but also crew members from around the world, sometimes from countries that have very, very high rates of ongoing tuberculosis, measles outbreaks going on, such as in the Philippines and other parts of the world. So the fact that we get cruise ships here that are sometimes introducing diseases we don't see frequently has helped bolster our infrastructure. And that, I was just going to say quickly, that really keeps a great relationship and partnership up with the state, with our federal quarantine station. We've got a really good, robust quarantine station.
You know, one thing I would add to that is here in Alaska, I mean, it's a small population, large geographic situation here, but a small population. And, you know, if you've been in Alaska for a while working in public health or in healthcare, it doesn't take very long to meet the key people. And you know, there's a lot of solidarity here. People really are willing to work together to solve problems. this is a pretty unique situation here in the United States that we have in Anchorage, Alaska. We have a state health department here. We have a local health department. We have a school of public health. We have three branches of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, all here in Anchorage. We've got a quarantine station, an Arctic Investigations Program, which deals with perennial infectious disease problems occurring in Alaska Native populations, and then a National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health station here. And then we have our tribal health partners and several major hospitals, and we all know each other. And so I think that's one thing that sets Alaska apart, is that we have really outstanding public health infrastructure in our state. And again, we all know each other and we get along really well and we collaborate. So in some respects, I think what you're saying, Lori, is probably accurate.
All right. I love it when I have my thoughts reinforced. Thank you so much, Dr. McLaughlin. We're going to hear from a caller now in Fairbanks. Howe is on the line with a comment or question about Ebola. Good morning.
Good morning.
You had a question?
Yes, I had a couple questions. I noticed they had a 21-day symptoms. Is there a way of determining a simple test if a person has Ebola, especially if they just got to the plane from Africa? And what is the risk of mutation of it becoming airborne or becoming less or more virulent?
Excellent questions. Thank you so much. That, you know, that kind of was something I was curious about as well and wanted to get to, is they are not infectious until symptoms start to present, but wow, that seems like there's some gray area in there. Mm-hmm. Do you always know when you have a fever right away? Or, you know, so Howe's question about, mm-hmm. is there a test?
Yeah. To answer the first question, there is a test. So once a person develops symptoms and starts to get sick, first of all, it's a little bit different than a typical viral illness where you might get minor symptoms and they might linger for a number of days and get a little worse and go on and you give a cough for a week. Usually once you get a fever, within days you are incredibly ill. It's not something that lingers for the most part. However, once you start to develop symptoms, there's a test that can be done that detects that. And we can't do it in Alaska, but we can take that sample and send it to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention overnight and have a result within 2 days. And that's what happened in Dallas as well. There are, I think, 13 or 14 states that have in-state capacity to do that test as well to get a result within a day or two. Now, once you've been exposed, let's say you're exposed to Ebola in West Africa, and let's say you're not going to develop any symptoms for the typical, which is about 8 days, there's no good test to see if you've been exposed, unfortunately. It's a matter of, you know, waiting and seeing if you develop symptoms. Mm. And then once you do, that test can become accurate. The second question in terms of
Mutation.
I know that came up in an article a couple of weeks ago. Someone mentioned the possibility, and it was, my take on that was, it was more of a what if. And if it were to, it would just be horrible. What I've read, and I'm no Ebola expert by any means, is that the chances are exceedingly low. I think that it would take many, many years and a lot more cases of sustained Ebola activity for even a chance of a viable mutated version of this virus to become airborne. So I wouldn't even, you know, go down the road of what if it were airborne, what would it do? I would just say the chances are exceedingly low, is what I've read. Yeah.
We also had an email question about if someone survives Ebola, would they still be infectious after the disease runs its course?
No. So, you know, again, this is a good time to highlight the fact that, you know, Ebola is not a new disease. Ebola was discovered, you know, for the first time, identified as an individual entity, a new disease, in 1976. And there have been numerous outbreaks over the years, all within Africa. So there's a lot known about Ebola. There have been a lot of studies about Ebola. So, you know, Ebola is not some, you know, the basics about Ebola are certainly not new.
One question that we also had from a caller was about how it's transmitted. And that was definitely a question that I had as well, because I've seen some varying accounts. I heard a doctor on a program a few evenings ago who I thought, unfortunately, was a little bit irresponsible in his response to it, because he said, look, unless somebody is bleeding profusely from their eyes and nose, you aren't going to get Ebola. But the article in the New York Times in the Sunday papers said that it can be transmitted through saliva, through tears, through possibly body sweat. Is that true?
It is true. So the Ebola virus is spread by direct contact with blood or other bodily fluids, and they can include vomit, diarrhea, urine, breast milk, sweat, semen. And these are all of an infected person who has symptoms. And this is one of the things that Dr. Cooper has done a very good job of just reiterating, the fact that you are not actually able to, the virus is not being secreted until you actually have symptoms. So you can be incubating the virus for, usually it's about 8 or 10 days, but can be up to 21 days and not shedding virus at all. But as soon as you start getting symptoms, that's when you know that that virus is shedding. But it can basically be in all the bodily fluids.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, I don't know if I answered that question earlier about the infectiousness later on. What the studies have shown is that once you have recovered from Ebola, then you are not infectious after a relatively short period of time. There have been studies that have shown it can be secreted in like semen for, I think, up to 7 weeks. But most available evidence suggests that, if you survive, and once you survive a bout with Ebola, that you're not infectious soon afterwards. And I think you've seen that in the U.S. with the physicians and people that have been infected that have been brought over, hospitalized for a period of time. They were not released until they felt very confident through monitoring and blood work testing that they were not infectious anymore.
We're going to take a quick call before we have to go to a break. Roger is in Anchorage. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I don't know how quick I can be, but I'll do my best. The topic today, it seems to be primarily Ebola, but I think it calls attention to broader issues of public health, building up public health infrastructure and capacity, and infectious disease. And I want to make sure your listeners and also your guests are familiar with the fact that there's a big global opportunity coming up very soon. Gavi, the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations, is the main international institution that makes sure that vaccines for kids are affordable. And obviously, we have a lot of vaccines that are out there that are effective and can save gazillions of lives. And we need to also recognize that there is a tie-in between making sure that poor countries, where most of unnecessary child deaths occur, the funding for vaccines and programs also helps to create and preserve the kind of infrastructure that's needed to detect and respond to sexy, if you will, high media interest, but relatively low numbers kinds of situation like Ebola. I mean,
right.
The opportunity with Gavi is over the next 4 years, if they get full funding, they could immunize 300 million kids and save potentially up to 5 million lives, which, dwarfs the kinds of numbers we're talking about with Ebola.
That's right, Roger. I think you're probably preaching to the choir here. I'm sure that we have supportive people who are very supportive of vaccines. What can you tell us, Dr. McLaughlin?
Yeah, Roger, thank you so much for bringing that up. And I hope that in the second half of this program, we'll have some opportunities to talk about vaccine-preventable diseases. I'm really here to sort of back Michael up. He's kind of taking the lead on the Ebola questions. But I do plan to talk quite a bit about vaccine-preventable diseases. Specifically, we're getting into influenza season and we've got whooping cough and other things going on. So I think we've got a break that we need to go to now. But I will go into a lot of the vaccine preventable disease issues and try and be available for questions that folks might have about specific diseases, vaccine preventable diseases. So.
Well, thank you. It's an interesting conversation. We will be talking with Dr. Mike Akeregi. He's the Chief Medical Officer of Providence Alaska Medical Center. We're going to talk to him briefly by phone when we come back, and Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
All right. Well, we don't have Dr. Mike Akeregi yet. These things happen in live broadcasts. But let's. I had a question, Dr. McLaughlin, about the treatment for Ebola. Right. And I know that people are interested in talking about flu and other things, and we'll definitely be talking about those in the second half. There's, I think, confusion about what the treatment protocol is because there's no cure for Ebola. But yet we have cases being successfully treated in the United States. What's going on there?
Right. So I'll go ahead and start, and I'll let Dr. Cooper add to what I say. But basically, the bottom line is once you've identified a suspect case of Ebola, the number one thing is to get that person in isolation and start treating them. You want to make sure that you're balancing their fluid and electrolyte balance. So you're giving them fluids, IV fluids and hydration, and making sure their electrolytes are stable. And you're also trying to maintain their oxygen status and their blood pressure. And then you also want to treat them for any complicating infections that might occur. The bottom line is you want to create as stable of an internal environment for that patient as possible so that their immune system can fight the virus off. Right now, you know, what we're seeing in West Africa is about a 50% case fatality rate, roughly. And so the good news is that 50% of the people do wind up overcoming this virus. Obviously, that's a very high case fatality rate, and it's one of the highest case fatality rates that we see in infectious diseases. And this is, it's a very scary virus in that way. But so right now what we've got for treatment is supportive care. There have been some experimental treatments that have, that people are working on. One is monoclonal antibodies that actually go in and attach to proteins on the virus and try to destroy the virus. And there are several other companies that are coming up with other experimental treatments, but none of that is widely available at this point. There also are companies that are working on Ebola vaccines. And so, again, but none of these vaccines are currently available.
Are you immune from Ebola? If you survive a course of the illness, would you not be able to contract it again?
Yes. With that strain. Yep. So you're immune from getting that strain again. And there are a couple of different strains in the world.
Yikes. So, yeah. Okay, well, 1-800-478-8255 is the number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's the statewide number, 1-800-478-8255, or locally in Anchorage, 550-8422, or talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's move on to enterovirus 68. Mm-hmm. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Enterovirus 68.
Yes.
What exactly is it? It seems like that would be a bigger risk for Alaska than Ebola.
Mm-hmm, yeah. You know, what I said earlier today was that even though most people may not have heard of enterovirus, they probably had it. Enterovirus is one of the most common bugs that causes the common cold every year. So every year, summertime, fall time, back to school, kids start to get sick with common colds, and enteroviruses are one of the top causes of that. Now, there are probably over 100 strains of enterovirus that circulate every year, and very few of those outbreaks of common cold ever get typed down to the actual strain. It's just not high yield. It's not cost effective. So what happened this year is that they started to see kids get sick with the common cold, but then to develop more breathing difficulties than you would expect to see with the common cold, especially in kids that had underlying asthma or used an inhaler or breathing difficulties to begin with. So when they started to see these clusters of kids getting very sick, having real breathing difficulties, having to spend a few nights in the hospital with, you know, oxygen or supportive care, they started sending samples off initially to the CDC to check what if this might be an unusual strain or not enterovirus, not a rhinovirus, something else. And what they found was that there's not a new strain, but a less common strain of enterovirus that was causing a lot of these illnesses called EVD68. You might have seen it in the news. Again, it was discovered years ago. It's caused illness in California and other states over the years. It's been detected even in Alaska before, but again, we don't test for it. We don't try to type things out to the strain level. There's just not a real high need for it. So, yeah, so this year what you've seen is now 40 plus, I don't know, 42 or 44 states have tested and confirmed that this particular strain of enterovirus is circulating in their states. And again, the things I think to highlight about enterovirus are that it's a strain of a common cold bug. It's causing especially kids with underlying breathing difficulties to have a triggering of their breathing difficulties and requiring, you know, extra care, hospitalization sometimes. So practice your common cold, common sense things. Mm-hmm. Wash your hands really well. Don't go in to school. Don't send your kids to school. Don't go to work if you're ill with this. Call your healthcare provider early if you've got those red flag symptoms like difficulty breathing, or if you notice your child having a hard time breathing with a common cold, don't hesitate to call your healthcare provider.
I know that some of the concern around enterovirus 68 has been the potential link, and I don't know that how much research has been done on this with some cases of partial paralysis in children. And it's not known if they're linked. Is there anything more known about what's going on there?
There are ongoing investigations. One thing that we were on a conference call the other day, they mentioned that in California, they've actually been looking into potentially increased numbers of this paralysis associated with some sort of infection for over a year, year and a half now. They've had a good number of cases. And they don't think that one is related to the EVD68 strain, but they've had some cases with that virus. It's not unheard of for enteroviruses, coronaviruses, Coxsackie viruses, rhinoviruses to sometimes cause worse outcomes in different clinical pictures, like a meningitis, like a pneumonia, sometimes, unfortunately, like a paralysis. So when you see a cluster, though, like they saw in Colorado, for example, they like to try to find out if there is a single cause. I know some of the kids in the Colorado cluster had the EVD68 isolated. Others did not. They had other viruses isolated. So at this point, it's an ongoing investigation. I don't think they've firmly linked most of the cases they're seeing a paralysis with this virus.
Nothing definitive at this time. 1-800-478-8255 is the number to call statewide if you'd like to join our conversation on infectious disease in Alaska. Or 550-8422 is the number locally. We do have Dr. Mike Akerge on the line now. Dr. Akerge is the Chief Medical Officer at Providence Alaska Medical Center. Dr. Akerge, good morning.
Yes, and good morning.
Thank you.
I've had the opportunity to listen to the last few minutes. It's been interesting to catch up.
Well, the reason that we, of course, reached out to you is we have state officials with us here, but we thought it would be good to kind of hone down a little bit to the hospital level and see how it works on the ground in the hospitals. What preparations has Providence made in case a patient infected with Ebola or other highly infectious disease ends up in your hospital? What's in place?
Well, I first should start with, as Dr. Cooper and McLaughlin said, there's ongoing preparation always. So there's always work around infection prevention at any healthcare setting, I would say, probably in our country. And that's no different in the hospital. We have, our nurses are grounded in infection prevention. We have a Department of Infection Prevention. We have several, we have an epidemiologist, but we also have several other infection prevention specialists, physician specialists at the hospital. So at this time, as has been mentioned, there's been a statewide call that we participated in, conferences. Our epidemiologist, Dr. Megan Clancy, our primary infection control physician, has been going to departmental meetings, including our emergency medicine department, and has helped put some things in place in the emergency department. And that's an important portal of entry, of course. At this point, there's been education to the entire nursing staff, the triage nurses. There's extensive travel histories being taken for all patients that are seen. And importantly, when the nurses do a travel history, our physicians can see that in the medical record, in our electronic medical record. And we've even had apparently a couple patients that have been put temporarily in isolation while additional information was sought. So as was mentioned, walkthroughs, drills, those are occurring, and they haven't just occurred and we're done. They're on an ongoing basis are going, and they will continue to occur.
What about enterovirus 68? This is another disease that hasn't, that we know of currently, arrived in Alaska. But are preparations for that, Dr. Akerege, different than they would be for Ebola?
Well, I would say not necessarily different. Remember, as we move into this time of year, we have certainly respiratory syncytial virus can be an issue, influenza can be an issue, enterovirus D68 mostly is affecting children with some type of pre-existing problem, although not entirely, but it's become a major respiratory problem for most of those children, and we deal with those in our pediatric intensive care unit and on our pediatric ward at the children's hospital. They're well prepared, and they are looking for those at this point. So the preparation isn't so much different. There's certainly isolation precautions that would be put in place just as they are with other airborne and other illness.
The federal government has put an emphasis on infection control at hospitals across the country, and hospitals have responded by getting much better at preventing infections. How does that work help as you're preparing to fight potentially new infectious disease? How has that impacted the protocols that you have in place?
Well, it allows us to modify them in a contemporaneous way. That we have a number of people that sit on all those calls. We get all the CDC alerts. We have a great partnership with the state. And so I feel like we stay well informed, and we do modify protocols, procedures, as recommendations change and evolve. So it's very fluid. A lot of stuff is basic, though. I mean, you can always talk about back to basics. We already heard about good hand washing and such, and isolating. Sometimes we have to cohort patients, but there are kind of standard practices, and any new stuff that comes up is attended to.
And thank you so much for being with us. My last question would be, do you think that the CDC is doing enough to get the word out, especially to rural clinics and hospitals? We had an email question from a health worker in Fairbanks who feels that Fairbanks is sort of out of the loop. And this comment was, we'd sure like to see the CDC visit up here and and make sure that people are really fully aware of infectious disease risk. From a hospital manager perspective, how do you feel that the CDC is doing in the state, especially in outreach around the state?
Well, I would say from my hospital-centric view that we have good communication. And I think that includes our critical access hospitals as well, but we also do rely heavily on our relationship with the state epidemiologist. I can't speak so much to Fairbanks, but I can't help but think that they actually have probably pretty good communication, and it may just be more a matter of the hospital leadership, infection control, et cetera, disseminating that message and that information a little better. And I think that's something, really a lesson for all of us. I think that's something we all need to do on a regular basis in practice.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Akhirgi, for joining us and helping us have a little more insight into what's happening at the hospital level.
It's been my pleasure.
All right. We're going to take another quick call from Rich in Sitka, who has a comment maybe about antiviral drugs. Hi, Rich.
Hi. When I was a kid and kids got polio in my neighborhood before the Salk vaccine, they pumped us all full of gamma globulin. I think that's how you say it. And then when I was an aid worker, before they had the hepatitis vaccines, they pumped us all full of GG again. And I say pump because it really took a lot of the stuff. And they just said it was to build up our immune systems to protect against viruses. Is that used anymore at all? Is that something health workers get or something like that? Or is that a completely discredited therapy now?
Yeah, it's still used, and it's not as needed as much anymore, but there are certain situations with certain diseases where you make the initial response. A vaccine is not going to become effective quickly enough. You have a person who's at high risk for complications, so you might want to give them sort of this gamma globulin, you did pronounce it right, and that might give them, you know, immediate protection already. Antibodies that someone else has formed that are preformed, that might help that person immediately, whereas a vaccine oftentimes takes anywhere from many days to weeks to provide protection. So yeah, it's absolutely used for certain conditions still today.
And I'll just add, Dr. Cooper mentioned that these are preformed antibodies. And so, you know, with with Ebola, you wouldn't expect to have preformed antibodies that would be able to fight the Ebola virus. And that's why gamma globulin is not given for Ebola to Ebola patients.
We'll take another call from, this is Rich in Anchorage. Hi, Rich. Rich? Well, he's gone. Okay, let's, we're going to move on then. Let's take a call from Juneau. This is Matt in Juneau. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you? I ran a drug and alcohol treatment center, inpatient treatment center down here for years, and we took patients in from all over the state and had a very, very high diagnosis rate of Hep C, and we called it the major Alaska closet infectious disease. And that is still occurring on our diagnosis on intake. I think we'd be remiss without having a discussion about Hep C. It is an extremely prevalent infectious disease among certain populations.
Yeah, thank you, Matt. This is Joe McLaughlin responding to that. So you're right. Hepatitis C virus is right now the most common bloodborne infection that we deal with. It's a very potentially very serious disease, can cause liver failure. And fortunately, now we do have an effective treatment for hepatitis C virus infection. However, the treatment is very expensive right now. This is a virus that we are working hard to combat. Unfortunately, one of the things that we're seeing here in Alaska, as well as in the United States in general, is an uptick in the number of cases of hepatitis C virus infection among young adults, mainly adults in their 20s. And this is coinciding with an uptick in heroin abuse. And so what's happening is with IV drug use, people are sharing needles. And so it's a really concerning resurgence of this disease in young adults.
Well, thank you for that call, Matt, in Juneau. And we're going to take a short break. When we get back, we'll talk a little bit about what we should be concerned about in Alaska right now in this fall season as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
We are back. This is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about infectious disease. It's the fall, and those things ramp up this time of year, as Dr. McLaughlin can tell us about. This is his job, is kind of overseeing everything for the state in this regard. So, Dr. McLaughlin, you had mentioned sort of an exercise that we could do.
Sure. So, Lori, what if I were to tell you that next month, the United States was going to see a totally new virus. Let's just pretend it's a totally new virus. And let's say I told you that anywhere from 5 to 20% of the United States population would get infected with this new virus.
Yikes.
And we'd be looking at, let's say I could say, I could tell you we'd be looking at about 200,000 hospitalizations in this country. And anywhere from 3,000 to 50,000 deaths, you'd be concerned, right? It'd be scary. It'd probably be scarier than Ebola, right? I mean, Ebola so far, we have seen, you know, 7,500 cases or so and about a 50% case fatality rate. Very, very scary, but not happening here in the United States. But if I told you that this new virus was going to come into play in a month and it would cause up to 50,000 deaths, we'd all be pretty scared if it was a brand new virus. And then what if I told you that in my back pocket right now, I've got a vaccine that's been tested in not just thousands, but millions of people. And I knew that it was one of the safest vaccines that we have available. And I told you that, you know, it was anywhere from 60 to 80% effective in, you know, preventing this disease. Would you want me to give it to you?
I'd call for a flu shot.
Okay. And what if I told you that it would cost $250 to get it, get the vaccine?
That seems like a small price to pay for staying alive.
Uh-huh. Great. And then what if I told you, okay, it's you, Lori, so I'm going to give you a discount. I'm going to say it's only $25 to get this vaccine.
Sold, Dr. McLaughlin.
Okay. So that's the scenario with influenza every year in the United States. We see hundreds of thousands of people who are hospitalized from influenza every year. And we get thousands of people who die in this country from influenza, and we've got a very safe vaccine that is widely available in this country. So that's the thing I really want to underscore to the listeners is what is at our back door, influenza is at our back door, and we have a good vaccine that can prevent the majority of cases. Unfortunately, in this country, we don't have high vaccine uptake. You know, it's very low. It's well below, you know, 30% of the population that gets influenza vaccine every year. So one of the things I really want to underscore is there are diseases that are a real threat here in Alaska, and infectious diseases, and many of them are vaccine preventable. The big one I want to promote right now is flu vaccine. The vaccine is currently available. It's being disseminated throughout the state. We want everybody 6 months of age and older, everybody 6 months of age and older to get vaccinated this year. This is the perfect time to get vaccinated. It usually takes a week or two before your immune system gets ramped up, actually, after you get the vaccine. So we know that every year we start to see influenza activity increase in November-ish. And it can peak as early as November, but it can peak as late as, you know, February or March. you know, other vaccine preventable diseases that we have here in Alaska, whooping cough is another one. We've seen hundreds of cases of whooping cough in Alaska that have actually been diagnosed, and it's probably the tip of the iceberg. And so, again, with whooping cough, we've got a good vaccine that's available as a series for children, and then we have a booster vaccine that's available for adolescents and adults. So,
I really appreciate that context. I think it's important because we tend to get wrapped up in concern and fear about something that is highly unlikely to land in Alaska, Ebola. But that's what grabs attention, and people are, it's in everyone's conversation. But you're right, the much greater risk to Alaskans right now is flu. Do you think that because we have the immediacy of news and the international connections that we all have now, does it hurt these awareness campaigns for things like flu? Because people are like, oh, it's just the flu. How bad can that be? But as the scenario that you laid out, it kills thousands of people every year.
Right.
Do people just get too afraid of this thing over here and not so much what's right in front of them? I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of boring to talk about the flu.
Yeah, it, you know, it might have that potential to do that. But at the same time, too, I think it gets things like public health out into people's minds, into their consciousness. And it gives us an opportunity to do things like address a question about Ebola, for example, in West Africa, but then take that and transition it, like we did on this call, to something that's probably more pressing for Alaskans, which is something like vaccine-preventable disease, influenza, pertussis. I was about to mention when Dr. McLaughlin mentioned pertussis that we're short two nurses today in our office because they're out in the field investigating a pertussis outbreak in a community that thought they had to shut their school down. They have so much. And so it's real. It's out there. You know, you name some of these diseases that people don't see very often, and we see them occasionally. We've had a measles case this year. We have some of these vaccine-preventable diseases that occur in Alaska. They just don't get the attention. So when something like Ebola catches people's attention, gets in the media, there might be the negative of, you know, too much media or too much, you know, concern. Why are we really talking about EVD68 again? But then that gives us the opportunity to talk about public health infrastructure. What is the state, what are the feds doing to really support a good, strong preparedness program and a public health infrastructure that can protect against any and all comers in the future?
Yeah, and we talked briefly about the history of infectious diseases in Alaska, and Dr. Cooper talked specifically about tuberculosis. You know, Alaska had very, very high rates of hepatitis A, of hepatitis B, very high rates of invasive streptococcal disease, Haemophilus influenza. All these have been largely controlled through vaccines. And looks like we're almost out of time. Sorry.
We are running out of time. This has been a fascinating conversation. Thanks so much to my guests, Dr. Joe McLaughlin, state epidemiologist, and Dr. Michael Cooper, head of infectious disease for the state, and also Dr. Mike Akerigi. Thank you to the crew, Dave Waldron, Josh Edge, Ashley Snyder. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week, and I'd love to have you doctors back at some point to discuss vaccinations.
Thanks for listening
to Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, with health plans designed specifically for Alaska businesses. Learn more at primera.com/newalaska, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.